This is John Howell, Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Well, it happened again yesterday. Another school shooting, this one in Nashville, Tennessee. Jim Ryan is covering this in Nashville for ABC News. The police chief had this to say earlier today. No knowledge of any sort of concern with the shooter.
Had it been reported that she was suicidal or that she was going to kill someone and had been made known to us, then we would have tried to get those weapons. But as it stands, we had absolutely no idea.
That is Nashville Police Chief John Drake from just about 90 minutes ago. The shooter was under treatment.
She was under care, doctor's care, for an emotional disorder. Law enforcement knew nothing about the treatment she was receiving, but her parents felt that she should not own weapons.
Well, the police and now the FBI are searching through social media postings of the shooter. I don't like to mention their names. 28-year-old took two assault rifles. I don't say assault style. Took two rifles, semi-automatic rifles, and a handgun into this private Christian school and murdered six people, three adults, three children. Now let's go to Jim Ryan, who's standing by in Nashville. Jim, any update on the motive of the shooter?
Well, not really. We have learned a little bit about the circumstances surrounding this, John, but I don't know if we'll ever have a motive. It's hard to say why people do these sorts. Even when the suspect lives and you hear what their motivation was, none of it seems to make any sense. But so while we don't have a motive, at least nothing that we've heard yet, there may be something written into this so-called manifesto that Audrey Hale left behind, but we do know about the circumstances. She had had mental health issues for a long time. The police chief said about an hour ago that Audrey Hale had mental health challenges and that her parents wanted her to get rid of the guns that she owned. She owned something like seven guns, all of them bought legally, three of them used in the shooting yesterday. But Audrey Hale's parents thought that those guns had been sold a long time ago. Well, three of them hadn't been.
Jim, weren't there text messages that were sent to somebody from the shooter right before the incident?
Yes. In fact, it may have been two people, but one person at least that we know about, and ABC has interviewed her. Paige Patton was a junior high school friend, a basketball teammate of Audrey Hale, and said that Hale shot her a text yesterday morning a little before 10 o'clock, said that she didn't want to live anymore, that she was going to do something. Patton says that she then tried to call a suicide hotline. She was referred over to the Nashville police non-emergency number. She called there. They said, yeah, we'll send somebody else to talk to you, but that didn't happen until long after the shooting had taken place.
Tennessee is an open carry without a permit state, and there's no red flag laws in Tennessee, are there?
That's right, yes. Although the police chief said that if they had an indication that this woman with a bunch of guns, this woman identified as transgender, but that there were a bunch of guns at Audrey Hale's disposal, they would have moved to try to get those guns taken away, go to a judge and try to have them taken away. That didn't happen. The police didn't know anything about this. So you're right. I mean, there's a lack of a red flag law here and permitless carry. You can walk around the street with these guns.
The attack was meticulously planned, I understand?
It was. This manifesto, or one part of it the police chief has been willing to share, John, talked about the planning that went into it, the maps that were drawn. Audrey Hale apparently had been a student at the Covenant School and so therefore was familiar with the entries, the entrances, the exits, where the school office was. Where anybody might have been trying to come in. So, yes, what's interesting to me and a little terrifying is that there was another location also that Hale had been checking out, had scoped out and decided that the security was too tight there. Now, the police chief hasn't said what that location was, but there might have been other people in danger as well.
And the shooter shot through the locked doors at this school.
Yes, and I'm not even sure that door was locked. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but Audrey Hale just blasted through these glass doors, crept in, and then was stalking the hallways. I've seen the surveillance video, the CCTV from the school, of this person walking around a red ball cap, backward glasses, a black tactical vest, camo pants, and three weapons, one rifle, a high-powered assault-style rifle held up to the shoulder. And Hale is sort of stalking kids and stalking adults in that school. It's a terrifying image that you see coming out of that surveillance video.
And the police, unlike Uvalde, once they heard shots, they went to the second floor, my understanding.
They did, yes. I've seen the body camera video that came from that. The officers moved in very quickly. There seemed to be one person in charge. That was not the case down in Uvalde. There was a person giving orders. They pushed and rushed right upstairs when they heard the gunshots upstairs and confronted the shooter. They opened fire first, and the shooter was down.
Pardon my ignorance on this. I know there are 6 fatalities. Were there any other injuries? And if so, how are they doing?
There were none. There were, the 5 people were taken to one hospital. These 5 victims, they died. The one victim was taken to another hospital. Don't know if that was a child or an adult. That person died. So the 6 people who were shot, all of them died from their injuries. No other injuries that came out of this.
No evidence that the shooter was targeting these 6 in particular, though.
Correct. The police chief was clear about that, that there appears to be no evidence that anyone was targeted. The school in general may have been targeted because Hale had this connection to that place. But as far as picking out individual kids, these 3 9-year-old children, or any of the 3 adults, including the director of the school, that does not appear to be the case.
In what you've seen, any of the 3 adults that were killed, were they trying to disarm the shooter?
There is evidence of that. The custodian who was killed, a 61-year-old man, was standing in the hallway. He was killed by the initial gun blast when Hale shot through that front door, those glass doors. That apparently was when this custodian died. There is evidence. The school director was found in a hallway by herself. The police chief said that she may have been approaching and trying to stop this, trying to confront the shooter.
Jim Ryan, thank you for the update in Nashville. We appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
There were locations. There was talks about the school. There was a map of the school, a drawing of how potentially she would enter and the assaults that would take place.
That's the Nashville chief of police again. So my question, it's up on our social media platforms. You can call, you can text. All right, what's the first thing you would recommend to stop the next school shooting? Nikki, Northwest Suburbs, wrote me, John, I've been saying this since 4/20/99. Metal detectors at the doors, security at the main doors, hall monitors like we used to have, and lock the doors. If a kid is late, buzz him or her in. They go through the metal detector and then get chaperoned to their class. Years ago, I went through the math on just public schools, not private schools, just public schools in the U.S., ballpark figure how many buildings there were, how many entrances, exits there were, and did the math on metal detectors. And it was billions, tens of billions. I don't know if you can harden these targets to stop lunatics. And even if you do harden that target, there's another one a block down the road, right?
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts, and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the road to a podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching The Stacking Benjamins podcast wherever you listen.
All right, with that background, let's go down to Arizona. Brett Gogol, WDLS's de facto sports director, former EP of this program, has seen some of the Sox and some of the Cubs. Brett, first, new season, new rules. Do these 3 new rules that are supposed to provide more great action, do you think they will actually work through a regular season of 162 games?
Yeah, I think if these spring training games, at least even just that I've been to, are any indication, I think it's going to make a massive difference. I think the one that you're going to notice the least is the lack of the infield shifts. So now each team has to have, every time a ball is thrown, two people on the infield with their feet in the dirt on each side of second base. So you're not going to see the shortstop over on the second base side of second base, the second baseman in the outfield. That's not going to happen anymore. So I think that'll benefit some lefty hitters. The biggest one is obviously, I think, going to be the pitch clock, where every time the pitcher is on the mound and there's nobody on base, they're going to have 15 seconds to throw the ball, 20 seconds when there is somebody on base. And I got to tell you, when I watched the first game we watched 2 days ago, and then we watched the Cubs and the White Sox yesterday, just an absolutely noticeable difference in the pace of play. I was sitting there on my phone for the first inning and a half and realizing, oh, man, I need to look up because this pitch is coming in. I'm used to being able to sit there for another 10 to 15 seconds before a pitch comes in. So I think that's going to be the one that makes the biggest noticeable difference, because you're going to have games that are going to have, I think, an average of under 3 hours, which is the main thing that a lot of baseball folks have been wishing for.
Yes, statistically, I noticed, it was in one of the papers the other day, that I think Rick Morrissey's column said that the spring training games have gone from an average of 3 hours and 20 minutes to 2 hours and 30 minutes.
Yeah, and like I said, it's noticeable. You're sitting there and you, without it ruining the game that you're watching whatsoever, it never feels like anybody's rushed, but it feels like everybody you're watching is Mark Brilli in his prime, where they get the ball, they step on the mound, the batter steps in, and then the throw is made. And it I think a lot of people are worried that it's not going to feel the same or look the same, or that it's going to ruin things. At least from my firsthand experience, it's been significantly improved. I like it a lot.
Get the ball, throw the ball. Get the ball, throw a ball. It keeps your defense in the game, too. And Brilli's a perfect example. He had a perfect game on the south side, which I could have attended and didn't. I know a lot of people say that. And I think that game, perfect game, came in at about 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Exactly. Speaking of Brilli, something that he was great at was pickoff moves, and that's something that's going to be a big focus this year as well. You're probably going to see a lot more stolen bases, and that's something that Rob Manfred and the MLB have wanted, is more action on the base paths. You have a new pickoff rule where basically a pitcher gets two chances to pick off a runner. If they go for a third time, they either have to get the runner out or they get to automatically advance to second base or third base, depending on where they're starting at. So it's going to be a lot more strategy in that way, and so I think you're going to see a lot more stolen bases this year.
I wonder what Ricky Henderson would have thought of that.
I think if he was playing, he'd be a big fan of it. But, you know, if somebody goes out and breaks his record this year or next year, I don't think he'll be as big on the idea.
Brett Gogol is WDLS's de facto sports director. Are you turning in all your receipts as business expenses from your trip down there?
I suppose I should. Thankfully, I'm staying. My parents live down here.
No, don't say that. Don't say that.
Sorry, we're staying at a 5-star Hyatt hotel. And obviously, you know, if they want to count my room service and all of my game tickets and my travel expenses, that'd be ideal.
Yeah, I think it's you're on the air. You were on Cochran's show yesterday, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Oh, yeah, you're all set. Turn all that in. Yeah, you were down there on behalf of the station.
Yeah, I'll get the expense sheet into to management right away.
Which team is more interesting?
I think the Sox are going to be the better team, but I think the Cubs will probably be more interesting, if only because the Sox, it's a lot of the same roster. It's weird when your biggest acquisition going into a year might be getting rid of Tony La Russa and getting a manager that I'm going to ask you, because I know you can't even pronounce his name most likely, Pedro Grifol.
Grifol.
Other than that,
it's Grifol.
Yes. Yeah. But there hasn't been much improvement on that team, and you've lost some key pieces. Liam Hendricks battling cancer. They don't know when he's going to be back. Yoan Moncada might start the year on the injured list. He's had a sore back, and that's what plagued them last year, was injuries, injuries, injuries. So they might see some positive regression to the mean when it comes to having more people available on the field on a daily basis. But at least with the Cubs, even though they're probably not expected to be as good of a team, I think there's more interesting storylines, at least. I'm really excited to see what Cody Bellinger can do for them. He's former MVP. He just hasn't been able to do anything the last few years with the Dodgers. He comes over, even though he's had a rough spring. Patrick Wisdom's had an absolutely monster spring so far. So I think the Sox, when you don't do anything, and you're, like I said, your biggest move is losing your manager, at least the Cubs seem to be doing something. They were playing well at the end of the year. So long story short, short answer to your question, I think the Sox will be the better team. The Cubs will be more interesting to watch.
There was one article this morning, I don't remember, can't give proper attribution to the writer, who said David Ross's honeymoon is over this year. COVID's behind. This is their second rebuilding in I don't know how many years, and something has to happen on the north side or he may be done.
I think as long as they show some positive progression as a team, he'll be in a decent spot moving forward. This is their over-under set at 78 wins, so they're projected to be just under 500. And they played about 500 baseball for the last month and a half of the season last year. So I don't think you look at David Ross and say that he's doing anything wrong as a manager. The difference is that this is arguably the first year that he's been the head of the team where they might be looking to make a push or at least be competitive, because they haven't had that the past couple of years. Basically, since they hired him, they've been rebuilding.
Did you see any ball players in bars or restaurants?
Haven't seen any in bars or restaurants. I thought yesterday's game was really interesting just because they marked it as an exhibition, and it definitely was. Mike Clevenger, who's been doing his own legal troubles this spring, started the game, was miserable in the first inning, got pulled in the first inning, and then for some reason was allowed back into the game to complete a few more pitches.
That's weird.
So nobody out at bars, thankfully, at least not in the areas that I've been in.
Excellent reporting on behalf of the station. Get that expense report in sooner rather than later. You never know.
Will do. I'll send it in. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Brett. Brett Gogol, WDLS News Room anchor and also de facto sports director joining us here. Thursday it is. Hope springs eternal. If you build it, they will come.
The one constant through all the years, Ray.
John.
Has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard. Rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray.
John.
It reminds us of all that once was good and it could be again. Oh, people will come, Ray.
John.
People will most definitely come.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Now you're
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Probably too young to remember this, but I've been in this town since 1988, and I remember when cops were respected here in this city.
You know, you're too young to remember this, but there was a time when policemen were respected, when you could go vote twice for Mayor Daley down at the 11th Ward.
Unfortunately, there's a new study out saying some Chicago police officers, their training is inadequate, and it is standing in the way of changing the CPD's problematic culture. We talked about our interim superintendent from a couple years ago, Charlie Beck, who is a longtime Los Angeles police chief, who said essentially, we don't have to work harder here, we have to work smarter. After lunch.
Wilma, I promise you, whatever scum did this, not one man on this force will rest for 1 minute until he's behind bars. Now let's grab a bite to eat.
I'm surprised to read at Axios.com about this the fact that we're falling short here in our training that is fundamentally flawed. Let's welcome the writer, Justin Kaufman, a fine writer and broadcaster and a former golf partner of John Dempsey, my former colleague and still friend. Justin, we just put in a $128 million training facility. How is it that we have a problematic culture when it comes to training in the city?
Hi, John, how are you, bud? This is a study that came out from a working group that was formed essentially to monitor the consent decree. We know that the consent decree is a federally mandated court order to reform. This came down in 2018. So this group is monitoring what is changing when it comes to the Chicago Police Department. So they put out a study. And the study essentially looks at the training that's put in place, the mandated training that's put in place to train the revised use of force policy. So the use of force policy was changed back in 2020 after this. It was a well-documented story at the time that they were going to change the way they did things at the Chicago Police Department when it comes to what kind of force could be used by officers. So to do that, they mandated this training. Well, this group came to the conclusion with the study, the scathing study that came out late last week, saying that the training is inadequate, that it's somewhat of a sham, and they also documented officers sleeping during the training. They were teaching in the training ways to cover up police brutality. They also were teaching some of the old things from policing, that the police officer's life is more important than anyone else's in the community, and that reinforcing the us against them mentality that has been pervasive in policing the last couple of decades. So that's what this study says from Craig Futterman and the University of Chicago, who's a University of Chicago law professor and part of this consent decree working group about this specific training.
You mentioned one name from the University of Chicago, but who else is a member? What other members of the working group?
It's mostly community advocate, working reform-minded people that were put together by the city. So it's going to be other University of Chicago people are on that list, including Professor Futterman. I don't have a list in front of me, but it's a lot of people that are representing the community in trying to get the Chicago police to adhere to the mandated reforms.
Justin Kaufman from Axios Chicago, would the rank and file of the police department say that they have an adversarial relationship with this committee?
They would. I think this committee was put together, and the committee actually gave several recommendations at the beginning, and Police Superintendent David Brown threw a lot of them out. Said, you know what, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do this. We're not going to do that. These were, you know, everything from recommendations on what to do with training to recommendations about community policing and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't say it's adversarial, but the group is not necessarily there to be, in lockstep with the police department. It's there to monitor their efforts to reform, which, as we know, has been hit or miss when it comes to the consent decree. Every year they'll put out the benchmarks that the police department has hit when it comes to it, and they're woefully fall short. So it's not surprising that this community group would say, hey, you know, or blow the whistle on what's happening with this training.
And that came out way back during the Obama administration. That was Eric Holder, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was really in response to Laquan McDonald. The murder. That was started it, and then it was reinforced in 2018, I think, when the federal court, for a while there, it was, if you remember, the Trump administration actually pushed back or pulled back some of the consent decrees under Justice Department head Jeff Sessions. And then as they changed it up and they went back and forth, they went back in the court, actually mandated the federal consent decree in 2018. I think it was 2019.
Has the FOP responded to this report?
They haven't. I reached out to the Chicago Police Department. They didn't give any comment. The FOP does not believe in anything really with the consent decree. So, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they have been steadfast against some of the reforms that have been put forth by the whether it be the new superintendent, David Brown, or I should say former now, but when he became new superintendent, or any of the stuff that comes from the court. So I would say that, you know, I don't know if they specifically have said anything about this particular study, but they definitely have been against some of the reforms that have been put forth in the consent decree.
Has Vallis or Johnson commented specifically about this report?
But they have not, but, you know, it comes on the heels of, you know, with Paul Vallis and Brandon Johnson talking about public safety on the campaign trail. It does come on the heels of the announcement late last week that the Chicago Police Department wants to bring back retired officers. They're recruiting retired officers to come back and fill some of the vacancies that are there. Craig Futterman told me, and you know, is one of the co-authors of the study, that that's something that they look at as well, saying, you know, a lot of these retired officers, people who left the force in 2020, 2021, when some of the policies changed, left in protest. They said, you know, I don't want to be a police officer if I can't do it my way or do it the way that I was trained. And they're not interested in retraining. So they were concerned that asking some of these retired officers back might be actually taking the force backwards as opposed to moving forward.
Justin Kaufman, what's next? Is this report just going to a circular file, or is somebody going to go through it, or does it get implemented? Or
I don't think it gets implemented. I think, you know, and we saw this is another, you know, you mentioned Charlie Beck, but he was part of another study that came out last week about reform, essentially asking, you know, here's, if you're looking for ways to police in the 21st century, to police in a way that might be different when you're talking about different leadership and training. They put out a report just last week as well that I wrote about that was more proactive, that was talking about solutions. This report was really just to say, we are monitoring, we're watching the Chicago Police Department, and they fell short. So I don't know if it has any binding. I don't think that, you know, any leader at the police department or even the any politician who's you know, up in city hall can really do anything about it except, you know, take the information and enact it in any way they see fit. But I don't think that there's anything binding to it.
Did you post the report at Axios?
It's there, yeah. It's in the study.
By the way,
the story I did.
Thanks so much for the link to all the great Richard M. Daley quotes.
He's got a lot, doesn't he?
Oh, they're so good.
I think this is a pivotal moment for Chicago Police. Obviously, they're trying to get a new superintendent, and there will be a working group that you know will be looking for public input. And the question is going to be whether or not they're going to move to more of, you mentioned Charlie Beck, but move more towards a Los Angeles style of reform, where they did enact some of these cultural changes. They did buy in the officers there, and they saw they saw significant drops in their violent crime. And there's a question of, and this study kind of alludes to it. If you change the culture at the Chicago Police Department, is it possible that that will have a impact on what we see of rising crime, violent crime, shootings, things of that nature?
By the way, I subscribe to Axios Chicago, and every morning, I guess not every morning, but quite often you'll post a picture, where is Justin Kaufman? And I correctly guess that you were in front of a Monk's pub that was last week.
That's right. Yeah, that was next week or last week. Monk's over there on Lake Street, which is you and hundreds others. I didn't realize this was such a Monk's
town. It's iconic. It's a Monk's town. And they have an entrance on Lake, and they have an entrance on Wabash, don't they?
Yeah. They do. And you know what's great about it? I went through the history of it. And not the first location. There were some other locations. But it's fascinating to think that the owner of that place essentially spent a year or summer in a monastery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When he was a kid, and then when he got this bar, he's like, I want this bar to look like those that that monastery that I spent my childhood summer at.
There was a lot of day drinking going on at Monk's.
Peanut shells on the floor
and,
a little bit.
Yeah. And along with Rossi's, which is just north of the river on State, it's been there 1,000 years. The darkest bar ever. You can't see in front of your face in either Rossi's or Monk's.
There's a couple of nights of Rossi's that I'd like to forget. There's no doubt about that.
I met Blagojevich there in 1994, and he told me at that time he was going to be president of the United States. I'm going to be president of the United States. My father-in-law is Dick Mell. And Rossi's. Like, okay, yeah, good luck to you.
It's a great Chicago story when you're talking about meeting governors at Rossi's. Right? I
mean, well, future governors.
Yeah, future governors, right.
All right, Justin, I'm a fan of your work. Axios Chicago, check it out. Sign up for the newsletter. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, John.
Take care.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
All right, baseball homeowners, openers, and mega concerts providing scammers with opportunities to steal your money, your identity, your tickets, and all the fun you were planning on having. So you have the Cubs opening Thursday at home, Sox are on the road. But this season, Beyonce, Taylor Swift, Madonna, Dave Matthews, and Springsteen, Lollapalooza, Pitchfork, Ravinia, Summerfest, and there's fake websites that are starting right now trying to sell you counterfeit tickets. I mentioned a couple minutes ago, a couple of times, that a couple buddies of mine were burned pretty significantly with counterfeit Bears tickets last year. Let's welcome for a discussion on how to protect yourself, Steve Burness, President, CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Chicago and Northern Illinois. Steve, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Doing well, John. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, the first thing we have to watch out for, fake websites.
It's still number one scam at the Better Business Bureau, fake websites, online scams. Because of the pandemic, John, as you know, everybody shifted online. Consumers, and guess what? The scammers go where the consumers are at. So unfortunately, the scammers are right there. And with the opening of baseball season, as you mentioned, and the concerts all coming to Chicago soon, the scammers will come out of the woodwork. It happens time and time again. And you would think because of electronic tickets, it's not. It does help, but it does not put an end to this type of scam, unfortunately.
These guys that were burned at Soldier Field had QR codes, supposedly. You know, these are supposedly, they can't be counterfeit, and yet they got to the ticket. You know, the ticket taker, somebody says, scanning their phone. No, tickets weren't good.
Well, the only time, John, you can tell if your ticket's not good or not is only by going to the venue. By looking at it, and I can't even tell, nobody can tell by looking at the computers, you have to read it. So you can be given an electronic or QR code, or even for Lollapalooza, a different a wristband, and you need to get in there because people don't know what it looks like or what it feels like. So the scammer banks on that. So the key, John, is, as you know, is always dealing with a reputable ticket broker, somebody that is licensed and bonded. So you have some protection. But people do get scammed going on the big sites too, but those sites will give you your money back or try to help you get other tickets.
But if I only buy tickets a couple times a year, who can I decide is a trusted vendor?
Well, obviously, you got to look at that they're licensed ticket brokers. Or the venue itself or licensed ticket brokers are the only two options for the that we suggest at the Better Business Bureau. Just going on Craigslist, it's like going in down a dark alley, John, and buying tickets from someone like that. You just don't know who they are. You can go to the Better Business Bureau website. We have a list of accredited ticket brokers like we do in every industry. We have businesses that are subscribed to our standards of accreditation. We have some information on them. But always do the research on them. Don't buy somebody from Craigslist because, just buying on Craigslist is from somebody like that, and buying tickets is not the smartest thing to do.
I see a lot of solicitations now for class action lawsuits regarding U.S. veterans for one ailment or another, one situation or another. How prevalent are these scams now?
They're getting pretty pretty prevalent now, John, with these scams, especially those marketing companies and law firms are putting a lot of money into advertising for Camp Lejeune. You've probably seen those commercials on, heard them on radio or seen them on TV. About $40 million was pumped in by these firms just to get people to call them back. And what happens is the scammers see that as well, and they try to bank on it. So they call consumers and military people, personnel, and saying that we can help you. We can help you with this. And so all we need is, of course, click on this link and provide us your personal information, John. And what they do is they steal your identity then. So people aren't waiting to take advantage of the military members, and it's so unfortunate. They're here to protect us and for our freedom, and unfortunately the scammers are taking advantage of the situation.
Well, there's a lot of class action lawsuit scams now. What are the two or three things we can do to prevent being scammed?
Well, never click on a link in a suspicious email. I think we've talked about that, John, time and time again. I think consumers get into most trouble by doing that. If you think it's a legitimate company or a legitimate offer, contact the company itself directly on the phone number itself or in the website itself. Don't click on those links. There's different variations of these scams, and they just kind of all allude to getting free money. And in today's world, there is no free money. You know what I mean? You got to be part of the certain situation where they will compensate you for certain things. So if they do a global promise, then you got to be very careful on that. And go through official channels, especially with the government and in the military, John. You want to go through your Veterans Administration. They can help you as much as possible. They have a separate section on those class action lawsuits like Camp Lejeune and others like that.
I'm getting a lot of emails now asking for contributions for tornado relief, especially down in Mississippi. How can I make sure they're legitimate?
Obviously, John, you have to do the research on the particular charity before donating it. I think give, but give wisely is what the Better Business Bureau suggests. And you got to look at the relief appeal. Is it clear? Who's getting the money? Who's the charity behind it? Sometimes they just pull on the heartstrings, John, and they don't tell you who they are or what they're going to do. And the charity that you're giving money to, you want them to be experienced in disaster relief, support experienced organizations that stand ready, to provide these quick and effective assistance in all these areas. And, be cautious of any organization or charity that form overnight in the wake of a disaster. And it happens time and time again, John. We've seen that these companies start to create these aliases and names quickly after a disaster or calamity, and they take advantage of the consumers in some way, and it's really disheartening because people do need your money. We want you to give, but give wisely, and check on those charities. The Better Business Bureau has standards for charitable accountability. We have 20 different standards, and we'll let you know if the charity itself or the nonprofit organization meets our standards.
BBB.org.
Before you buy or hire, BBB it, John.
Steve Burness, thank you very much for your time. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks, sir.
Have a great day. Thank you, sir.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Former Navy SEAL Sean Ryan shares real stories from real people from all walks of life on The Sean Ryan Show.
Comedian John Crist.
How long have you been in Nashville?
Let's see, 2018 is when I moved here. I lived in an apartment. I didn't know anything about it. I lived in L.A.
You were living in L.A.? How was that?
Yeah. Well, let's see, good for my career. Send me to rehab, though, so. That's pretty much the sum of it.
The Sean Ryan Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.